just before we dive in to the episode, I wanted to let you know that my course, Your First Byline, is open for enrollment. So if you're the sort of person who has been aching to get into freelance writing and get your first byline, but you just don't know how, if you want to promote your business by writing an article and cementing your authority and get it into a newspaper or a magazine, but you just don't know where you find the journalist details, how you pitch to an editor, and what to do if they actually commission you, how much to charge and what to write and in what format, I can help you with all of that. I've been doing it for about 5 years now. I've got hundreds and hundreds of bylines in national newspapers, in glossies, and I really want to help you see that it's actually a really simple process. I had some amazing students in my May enrollment who went on to get bylines in the Metro, in O'Cumley, and I really want that for you too. So if you've got any questions, feel free to email me. All of my details are in the show notes. And if you don't have any questions and you want to go straight in and sign up, then you can do so in the show notes. There are payment plans and VIP options available. You're listening to What She Said, a podcast about blogging, creativity and life online, hosted by me, Lucy Lucraft, a freelance journalist and blogger based in Brighton. Today is episode 9 and I couldn't be more excited to welcome Kate O'Sullivan back to the podcast. She was one of my guests back in season 2, so we chatted just about her really super varied career. We talked about her online gap year, which she took just before she came out online, and her career journey that's taken many wiggly turns along the way. In this episode, we mostly chat about her experience of being part of the LGBTQ plus community online. One of her big things is making sure that she creates safe spaces online. Now, it's a bit of a different episode, I guess, in that we don't talk blogging tips and tricks. I really, really hope you enjoy the episode. I think you will. Kate's brilliant. Welcome back to the podcast, Kate. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really good. Thank you for having me back. That's reassuring.
It's always a good sign, isn't it? So for anybody who doesn't know who you are, can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your blogging journey so far?
Yes, I can. Thank you. My name's Kate, and I used to host an online space that I called A Playful Day. It was my kind of alter ego to hide behind, if you like. The idea was to kind of document bits in every day that made me feel good. And I started it during a time when I had really poor mental health. I was technically homeless. I was sofa surfing, having escaped domestic violence, and really trying to piece together my life. And that was a part of me that I tucked away, and I concentrated on this playful side of me. This, you know, I'd share a recipe one day and I got my camera out that I hadn't been using it, and really sort of got onto this blogging and online thing about maybe 8-9 years ago. And I never really talked about why I started. I just said, oh, you know, it's a rallying cry for sort of a whimsical approach. Let's really try and find a good moment in every day. And I think as I went along, I started to realize that there were so many stories that I wanted to tell and I wanted to hear, and I started a podcast that was called A Playful Day. And over the years, I started to sort of evolve a community that were really excited about the sort of inspiration that women find from making and creativity, because I did a lot about craft. And I started to realize that I was really showing a lot of my feminism. I'd always identified as a feminist, but maybe not really acted upon my feminism. It was like a good idea of like, yes, this seems like a good thing that I should be. And then I realized it was sort of moving in this direction. And over time, I've evolved it so that my podcast recently relaunched. It's now Conversations from Our Days, to make the conversation part much more central. So that's been my kind of journey.
Very eloquently done. So before we get into what I kind of want to talk to you about today, I shared something yesterday on stories about the fact that you are such a brilliant ally, and you have been the whole time that I've known you over the past year, when you were a playful day and now as you are. You're not just an ally of one marginalised community, you're an ally of all. And I know that sometimes that loses you followers. And I just wonder how that feels for you, because you are in a marginalised community yourself. So it's not like it's super safe for you to do this.
Yeah.
So but how does that feel, and how would you encourage other people to do it as well? Because we should all be doing that.
Yes. It's a hard statement to say we should, because I agree. I really do. It shouldn't be on some of us to make these spaces safe enough for everybody to feel they can step into. Mm. I think it's hard, like, sort of firstly I should explain to people listening, like, I'm gay. I came out late in life, and part of the reason I came out late in life is because I came out to myself. I didn't realize I was gay until approaching 30s. I started to realize that the reason I was staring at girls wasn't because I really liked their haircut or like, oh, I really like her sense of style. I always seem to go with that girl with that sense of style. I actually realized, oh, I like girls. Despite really early, like, you know, my first ever sexual experiences with a girl, it wasn't with a boy, and yet I shut that down. And that sort of internalized homophobia isn't uncommon. And I hid from myself. And to hide from yourself for that long and then to realise afterwards, it's quite a grieving process as well as a celebratory process when you realise and you sort of step in to who you are. And I think part of that is you're not being your truest self. You're not being as authentic to your identity as you could be. You're not owning who you are and claiming your space, and you're not free to think without there being these barriers that often for me I couldn't even put my finger on, like, why is it that I feel like I don't fit, or why does that particular imagery bother me, or why does this stuff cause like this huge anxiety in me, because I'm not that, and I don't know what I'm not. You know, I couldn't articulate it. And I think for me that then has fed into the way I've gone about my blogging life, my podcasting, the way I use my platform, any social media, because I have so much time for people really exploring their own identities and seeing other people's, and that just coexisting. I'm not a big fan of the word tolerate. It's been a big thing around, we need to teach tolerance. I tolerate going to the dentist and having my tooth removed because it's good for me. I accept that there are things in this world that are challenging and that I will personally find difficult, but I really want to invest in, and I want others to be able to live and thrive as their most authentic self. So I think that's why, if I ever think of softening something or maybe leaving something, or I don't really know if that's my place to say something. And sometimes my job as a cisgendered white woman, you know, I still have a lot of privileges, is to be quiet and not take up that space and to make sure there is room for others. But a lot of the time I look and I think, I can't see anybody else hosting these conversations, and people are here because I think, from what I've you know, I did a survey a while ago with all my listeners, and it's like, tell me about the podcast, like, what kind of words would you use to describe it? And a lot of them were like, you're a bit of a compass, like, you're just pulling people in and showing them different directions they could be going on, and you're really advocating, and you're very honest, and you're sort of very approachable, and you're really compassionate. And I mean, God, doesn't any human being want to be called those things? You know, it was hugely flattering, and I had to have a little cry. I was like reading this survey monkey, like, oh, I need some chocolate tea. I was quite a mess reading it, because I was expecting them to say, like, oh, I really like the way you do your sound, or I was completely unprepared for this. I was like, oh,
your graphics are great.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was like, oh, I'm gonna have all this list of things that I need to get better in, like my timings or something. And I just sort of sat there with like this pen and paper, like, not writing anything down but just bawling. Because it meant so much to me to be seen and to be understood at the level of where I have been. You know, it's very raw to have escaped domestic violence, to have battled mental health, to have realised that you're gay, to, you know, I was a single parent on benefits. I've been on benefits for the best part of a decade, on and off. And just all of those things just to, that make you feel so excluded sometimes and just so exhausted. It really matters to me that other people feel held, because I needed to feel it. So I guess it doesn't feel optional as a result, is the end result of all that, I think, is a long way of explaining it. It just, I don't need numbers to tell me that human beings are great on the internet, you know? I really enjoy the community that I have built around. You know, they're great. They send me amazing and interesting posts that other people have shared, and they suggest awesome guests, and they tell me their stories, and they react to, you know, I had a great blog post that I shared on from Frenchie as a multicultural woman of colour, and how she feels with that sort of liminality of living between identities. And it just so resonated for so many people. And I had all these emails, like, I'm trying to get hold of her and I need to tell her this, my story. Will you pass this on? And these stories were beautiful. And I just saw, like, what's a few hundred followers in the light of like 4 or 5 people who finally saw themselves, or felt heard, or felt like they had somebody who signaled safety to them on the internet. Like, that's, that matters so much more to me.
Oh my God, yes. Yes. 100% yes. But I think I don't see this very often. Out of all the people that I follow online, I feel like I follow a fair amount, but even after all the culls that I've done...
Well, you have to sometimes just to see people. So.
Well, that's it. Yeah,
fighting the algorithms all the time.
Something that I really don't see on in the people that I follow, and in kind of mainstream crowds on Instagram, is people advocating for others and being an ally. And I wonder why.
Yeah, I think people. It's a number of things. I think people find it really hard to know what to say sometimes. I really do. And I think the fear of that can be quite paralyzing. And my experience being on the receiving end of that, as somebody who doesn't then feel seen as a result, is that I would rather people tried. And I've had it. And the big difference is how you respond to someone saying, oh, did you mean that to be hurtful? Because if you double down and, well, no, I'm not homophobic as a response, because we often go to the extremes, don't we? It's like, if someone says, actually, when you say that, I don't know if you realise that actually that's part of our conditioning that makes you say that, and it's quite homophobic. And trying to explain that to someone, to then be greeted with this outrage that you could think that they're homophobic, because we know that that's bad. And I think there's a lot of people who, particularly a couple of my friends have described this exact scenario around racism. It's like, actually, when you said that thing about colorblindness, actually, it was quite offensive to me. And here's why. And I really need you to understand it, because I want us to have this relationship. And the big difference for them is when that person goes, oh, and listens and reflects, and what they do with that fear and that lack of knowledge that they had. Like, we can't know everything. Like, I think the biggest advice I can say when people are like, how to be a better ally, I'm like, I don't know, just accept that you're not going to know everything, that we are conditioned in certain ways, and that is layering. And if it was that simple, we'd have fixed all these oppressive factors by now. You know, if we're like, you know, if racism or homophobia or ableism or transphobia or so many isms, like fat phobia, if any of them just walked up at the most extreme example every time in a way that you could point your finger and say, this is bad, we'd have fixed it. But it doesn't work like that. And so I think there's that factor of people not knowing what to say, but actually sometimes it's really important to have a go, because what you're signaling there is that you have good intentions, but also you need to understand that good intentions can still hurt, you know, like, say things with the best of faith and it can, you know, we've all done it, that sort of like, whoa, I did not see that reaction coming. I really put my foot in it there. And it's, you know, we know how hard it is to then apologize in those situations, but that's a skill, and that's something that we have to be prepared to do if things are going to change. But I also think that it's very hard to see the layers that go into keeping you within your own echo chamber, and that make it hard to speak up, and that make it hard to see what you're adding to you sometimes. And it, and there is something quite painful sometimes when you see it. You know, I very much went through this process with, you know, it always mattered to me that I got a variety of voices on my podcast, and you can definitely see the beginnings of that. You know, I started doing seasons, and I actually started keeping track of who I was inviting on and kind of what their identities were. Like, did I have someone from a working class background? Did I have a woman of color? Did I have somebody who was able-bodied? Did I have somebody who identified as, you know, non-binary? You know, I started making this, and I realized that I was failing and I was lacking. And the reason is because of the way I've been brought up. I've been brought up with a lot of privilege. There are certain spaces that I inhabit because I'm used to dominating in them. And not because I'm a dominant person, but because I get more privilege in those areas. And, it, you know, having to then go, okay, and having to then really push against what I had been brought up and accepted as truth, and then realizing that I was part of the mechanics, I was benefiting from the oppression of others, and I had to now step out of my privilege, out of my comfort zone, and really be prepared to learn. And I think it's hard for us to see that sometimes, and it's, in fact, most of the time, not even sometimes, I think it's just because it's, you know, it's everyday life. We often say, well, I live in a very undiverse area, so it's really hard for me to make, you know, a more representative bubble around me. Okay, think about the statement that you just made. You live in a very, you know, homogenous looking environment. There's a reason you're in that postcode. You know, that doesn't make you a terrible human being. That means you're a result of the conditioning that is in our society. I do. You know, I just, you know, I live in an area that is pretty homogenous. It's taken quite a lot for me to develop relationships and, you know, business contacts and those networks around me that are diverse, because I had to actively go and seek them in order to do it. And it gets easier. You know, it's funny, like once you do it, it just grows and grows and grows and grows. And I can really see that in my online life and my real life. I hate saying real life. And my offline life, sorry. Yeah. I think real could be such a derogatory term sometimes. And yeah, so I think we need to sort of, while it's not okay to sit in it as an excuse, like once you realize, you kind of, okay, what can I be doing more? And it doesn't have to be flag waving and beating the drum. Like, hell yeah, sometimes I'll wave a flag and I'll beat a drum because that's what it takes. But it can be looking around of like, oh, the last time I shared an e-course with my friends, it was another woman who looked exactly like me. Okay, I need to think about that, because I'm just amplifying the voices of me. Because they all are just a mirror of myself. Okay, who am I amplifying? Because, you know, I'm just perpetuating an idea that only people like me can succeed otherwise. And that's a hard thing to do initially, because society's set up that way to make it easy for you to carry on with that, down that path.
And I think it's important to say that at the beginning, and I'm certainly not, I wouldn't class myself as an ally, maybe in training.
We all are. I don't think anyone's there.
In progress.
Like, I think, like, some of the best activists that I follow, like, they make mistakes. We have to be fallible.
That's true. That's true. Being. Yeah.
We have to be allowed to make mistakes. And I think the minute you're like, you know, I'm always really wary of people who really strongly identify. If someone says, I'm an intersectional feminist, I'm always like,
Yeah.
Be careful now. That's sounding like a badge. I can usually see it in someone, their belief systems and what they stand for. And that to me is somebody who's further along the journey. And usually those people are the first to be like, my bad, knocked over a thing, made a mistake.
Yeah, I think that's right. Because, yeah, so when you're, it doesn't always feel, especially at the beginning, once you've worked out one area of ism that you have, that you don't want to have anymore, it might feel unnatural to start seeking out and sharing things that you didn't used to share, and that's okay. It doesn't have to be, I don't know, that's something that I've struggled with when, and it really brought it into focus when you shared a post, and I can't remember who it was by, and you said tap through, I can't remember how you worded it, it was really funny. Oh, no. Hate to be the only queer in your village or something, or the only queer in your phone.
Yeah, the only queer in your phone, that's what I said.
Yeah, you did.
I'm your diversity quota for the day.
But it really brought it into sharp focus for me, because I thought, hey, yeah, like, I've got gay friends. I'm not homophobic. Oh my God, my phone is straight as.
Because that's what we do, and it's always, we sometimes play ism bingo. Yeah. It's like, I can't be racist. I went to my friend's Muslim wedding.
Oh my God,
that
yes.
is always a sure sign that someone's being too defensive.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I have gay friends. It's like, I am gay and I have homophobia. Like, I've internalized it and I hate myself. So I'm fairly sure if I can do it,
we can all do it. Too, you know? But that was really powerful because it just made me stop and think, oh, yeah, okay, there aren't really that many people from the LGBTQ community in my phone, you know, as if they're just a fan club or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey guys,
we're just there with our rainbow glitter to get it on whenever you feel ready to turn us on like a light.
See you at Pride. What would you say? So I want to take it back a little bit, because in terms of LGBTQIA+,
yeah,
I think, and I know I personally get so confused about what labels you should use, what labels you're allowed to use, what terms you should use. And, you know, this comes back to, I don't want to say anything in case I offend somebody. Mm-hmm. But also, I think, you know, there is Google.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I utilize a lot. Which helps to educate people. But for the purpose of this podcast, what is LGBTQIA+?
Okay. So there's always a debate about what is the most inclusive term to use for a lot of communities. This goes wider than my own. But I think traditionally we thought of gay as there is lesbian and there is homosexual men, gays, and that's it. And then there was obviously people who went, well, I kind of like both. And so, okay, cool, bisexuals are in there. And then the idea around there being a fluidity around gender and around sexuality has become a more and more important issue that we don't erase. Mm. And I'm really careful about how I phrase that, because there's a lot of people who feel like, well, there's been like this explosion, like we've got all these like different sexualities and genders, and what does non-binary mean, and what does intersex, which is the I in LGBTQIA, and what does asexual mean, and well, is it me, or like we're suddenly really worried about all these transgender kids that are suddenly appearing. Like, we need to reframe that conversation, because up until recently, people who always felt that way were not allowed to be part of the conversation, and we're just not promptly heard from. It's why we talk a lot in sort of intersectional feminism in terms of like a plurality of voices. And until we have everybody's voice, we can't really fully understand systems of oppression and solutions, because we're not hearing from the people that it affects of what their lived experience is. And in answer to the idea of there being a rise in anything, you know, we have to remember that 50 years ago, we strapped kids' hands behind them when they wrote with their left hand.
Yeah.
It didn't mean there weren't left-handed kids. It just meant there were a lot of kids who developed stutters and stammers and were very unwell psychologically as a result. I think we're just seeing the same phenomena. Mm. We're just allowing people to finally be themselves. And that is so important. And so the labels thing's always tricky, because you don't want to be offensive by using the wrong one. Mm. But I think the most important thing is allowing people the space with which to self-identify. It really matters to me at this point in my life that I identify as a lesbian, previously I've identified as bisexual, mm-hmm. and I will fight to the death over the idea that bisexuality is a phase. It's just people haven't picked or being greedy, which is a very common two myths that you come against, like two really massive bits of stigma that just make me want to rage and tip tables over. For me, bisexuality was like a safe space. It was like a, I think of it, I was describing this to someone the other day, I think of my bisexuality like I would like a really loving relationship I had once at university. Like, I think of it fondly. It was a space in which I was able to open up and say, I have this these feelings for women and I'm not sure what to do about them. And for me, I started to find a sort of a queer family, and that was really important to me. And I realized within that that I had been allowing myself something, that actually that was the thing that I really wanted to be. And I think I always understood that sexuality was a very fluid thing. Like, this is me at one phase in my life. It's not me forever. I, in case my girlfriend decides to listen to this, is this forever, darling? Careful how I word that. But, you know, and there are people who, they very much change the way they feel about their sexuality. I've heard from a lot of women who decided, that sounds like, oh, we suddenly decide we're gay. That's really not helpful. That's part of something that I'm perpetuating there. So they realize and they start to identify within themselves feelings that they've perhaps always had, or emerging feelings that hadn't allowed to have. They now maybe they're not attracted just to their husbands, that they're attracted to women, and they've never been able to explore that, but they're in a perfectly safe relationship now with someone very loving, everything's set up, and they still have the right to identify as that. It doesn't have to be performative. And so these labels become very important in that, and that people sometimes just hearing them. I can remember the first time I heard, you know, pansexual. I can remember sitting there thinking, what does pansexual mean? Am I really queer if I don't know what this means?
What like, does I pansexual should know. Mean?
Basically, the idea of pansexuality is you're attracted to any gender, and the difficult conversation that is often had is around whether bisexual or pansexual is a safer label.
I see.
And I've got a podcast episode that probably by the time this goes up is about that exact topic.
Oh, brilliant. I'll link to it.
Yeah, because it is really important that we don't erase other people's experiences sometimes in trying to identify our own, but you can only go on your own journey. And as long as you are making sure that, you know, you're saying, this is me, this is where I am, this is a safe place also for these other people, you know, we're all there, we're all existing. I think that's kind of, that would be my advice to kind of starting to navigate your way around labels. And yeah, Google. The first time I went on like an all queer dating app, I think I had like the app in one hand and Google in the other. I was like, I don't even understand what half of these terms mean. How the hell am I going to date someone? And you know, even within the queer community, you know, there's nothing like queer politics. We will devour each other if, you know, if there is, because it hurts so much to have your identity erased, and we really feel that deeply. And sometimes it can hurt so much more painfully when you see it come from within what you feel is your queer family. I've seen some pretty intense, you know, altercations online, which really have completely centered around people were not given the freedom to self-identify, and that is so important.
Yeah, and I can relate to it from the only way that I can relate to it, which is not even remotely the same, but just of my own ethnicity, when somebody within my same community referred to me as white, and I had said to you, like, this really hurt me more than if a white person had, which they do all the time.
Yeah, it's true, and I think that's, you know, they're not the same oppression. But I do think sometimes we can really learn from each other's experiences in that way. And I think that's what I'm trying to tease out with the podcast sometimes is, no, this isn't my life, but hold on, there is a foothold here, something that echoes something I know.
Yeah.
Maybe we're not so different.
Yeah, and I think that's really powerful as well, to not say it's just like me. which is basically what I just did, but yeah, no, you know what I mean. Fine.
No, I was actually agreeing with you, but I managed to make it sound like I wasn't. No, I was completely agreeing. And I think part of the reason that I've been careful is because I think, you know, when we're talking about oppression, I think we need to be really clear that for me, like, there are some oppression goes through everything. Like, class cuts through so many things, and it's such a major factor in terms of people thriving. And, you know, some of the homophobia and transphobia is horrific, and people do die as a result. But I think in terms of race and ethnicity, there are so many ways in which you never get to pass because of your skin color. You never get to have a day off. You are always, always seen as that identity first. And I think people have a really hard time understanding why sometimes that is such an important a system of oppression to recognize, because it's pervasive, and it's destroying lives, and it's really inhibiting people in a way that I can step off sometimes. You know, yeah, I have, you know, I joke about having a very queer, well, I don't joke, I take it very seriously. I have very queer style. I wear my, you know, sexuality because it's part of my identity. You know, I go to a queer barber's now, that really matters to me. But I can choose to kind of blend if I want to.
Yeah.
And I think that was me trying to be very clear that I understand that difference as a white woman.
Yeah.
And that really matters to me, that people know that I get it. Like, I get a day off.
I was talking to somebody about this recently, offline. From my point of view, I think because I feel ashamed of myself, because I can very easily pass as a white woman, I have had double privilege in that I can pass as a white woman, not when I was younger, but now. But I can also say, oh, hey, I'm not one of you. I can also pass as, who I am, which is Arabic. So I can do both. And the fact that I didn't really deny. Yeah, I suppose I did. I led with my whiteness. And because I did that for so many years, I almost feel more of a responsibility now to say, oh, yeah, you know what? I am half Arabic, or I'm Arabic and British, because somebody who is black, yeah, they don't have a day off. They don't have that choice to jump into, oh, I'm going to be white today because that works better for my day. I'm going to a particularly white event, so I'm just going to jump into that camp. And then tomorrow I'm going to see my, you know, I'm going to go to a black event, and therefore I can jump into that. Like, that is not an option.
Yeah, but isn't that just such a sad statement? There were so many emotions that you described there. Like, you talked about shame a lot and being ashamed of yourself. But I think we're really taught that shame around, like, that's what you learn to do in order to survive, to be more palatable and to be more acceptable in a very racist society.
Yeah.
Like, that galls me to hear you say it. And I really hope other people sit with that discomfort as they hear you describe that. That's important that we acknowledge that's how you've learned to survive. And you're right. It does put you in a position that then you do want to sort of level up in your allyship of, like, I can relate to some of this experience. There is an echo here that does not feel good. And now I know it, and now I can see it and I can feel it. I know what I can personally do to try and help others. And it's there was a great interview that I did with Imreal Morgan. She calls herself the Inclusivity Queen, and she owns that title. She really does. She's great. She runs a podcasting network, and she's very much about amplifying sort of marginalized voices. And she talked about, it's not a problem to have privilege. Like, she talks about, like, I enjoy my privileges. Oh, yeah, I bask in them sometimes, like, because I enjoy some. Because in other areas of my life, I experience so much oppression as a black woman. And she really articulated, it's not about the privilege. It's what you do with it that matters. If you're wielding that privilege, that's not okay. If you're sitting in it, like, using it as a barrier, that's the problem. But you're allowed to enjoy it every now and again. Like, you're allowed a day off. And it just, oh, it was just so powerful when she said it, to hear her really sort of articulate the difference to me of when it tips over into not okay. I was like, yes, that was the thing I couldn't put my finger on. Thank you. And that's what I love about conversations. If we're, you know, it's not just sometimes about saying this is a problem and you have to accept it. And well, sometimes people do just have to accept it. Like, this isn't okay. We need to stop using this language. But, you know, when you have the conversation, someone will then articulate something in a way that you go, ping, light bulb. That's why I couldn't get it. And it just helps you reshuffle and reframe what, you know, for 30 odd years of your life, you've accepted as truth.
Mm. I think your recent, it was actually for your Patreon. Was it just for your Patreon? The live with Frenchie.
Yeah.
She was great. It was so powerful, was how she broke down cultural appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
I understood to a level of cultural appropriation, but the way she broke it down, I was like, yes, that's what it is, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it really helped me to understand. You know, she just said, I saw the question, where are the people, where are the people whose work you are using?
Mm.
You can say you're appreciating it, but if those people do not exist in that appreciation, you've moved into a position of power. And what's more, if you are profiting from it, if you are making money from it, we are really into cultural misappropriation now. That to me was like, it was just such a simple baseline that should be so obvious, but I hadn't been able to find the words with which have sometimes I've just had a, ooh, squick when I've seen something like, something doesn't feel right. I don't like this picture and I don't know why.
Mm.
It just feels like an appropriation is I didn't see the people. And that's what it boils down to, is that, you know, you've removed the culture from the cultural reference.
Mm.
You know, that's important to be able to see the difference, and that sort of helped with that line for me of where it stops being educational and appreciation, and it moves into something that's part of a sort of colonializing of culture that is really, it's not a good look. Let's not.
Let's just not go there, guys.
Let's
come
just
on.
Not. Let's take a look at our photo booths, because they're the worst offenders. Let's take a look at some of these things we get up to, our holiday pictures with our hair braiding. Like, let's really think about it. Like, it's so common. Some of these situations, it's just harmless fun. But it's that harmless fun that you were at the weekend at the party with a photo booth with your fake afros and your sombreros. Cool. Okay, so now somebody who actually comes from that culture comes into a bank manager, asks for a loan. You know, you're telling me that didn't inform your decision making. Mm-hmm. So we've got to be a little bit careful about, you know, how far we take these supposed jokes that are in good humour.
Yeah, 100%. Because it's just a hop, skip and jump away from blackface, you know, years ago.
I suppose in Australia, they were doing it and dressing up as Serena Williams recently. Yeah. And they blackface. I mean, we're in a society, we can't hide behind that was something that happened long ago.
Yeah,
and we've got to be, I saw something great with someone articulating it, people, it was okay in this day and age.
Mm.
And someone said, I'm fairly sure to the people that it was oppressing, it wasn't okay. And I was like, that's an excellent point. That is also another, we are making ourselves feel better that, well, that used to go on, but we don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
That we're trying to anaesthetize our pain by saying that. It's okay. This is uncomfortable. Let's dig into it.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that you, just before we end it, I wanted to ask you about, when people say, and I know this infuriates you and I totally understand why, but I'd love you to elaborate on it. When people say, I can't believe this happens. I can't believe in this day and age, particularly probably in reference to perhaps you've talked about experiencing homophobia, or it literally could be anything, but
mm-hmm.
I can't believe it happens in this day. It's 2018. I can't believe there's homophobia.
Mm. It's really hurtful. It's my first experience. Like, I pull up short when I hear it, and I don't see somebody who is a safe person when I hear it, despite the fact that they're expressing shock. And sometimes it is really shocking what you're hearing, and sometimes it is really painful and it's really uncomfortable. You know, some of the things that I have witnessed online, I have gasped out loud that people think it's okay to say things like that to someone. But what's really important in that moment is that someone who is a victim of that understands that you see their pain, that instead of centering like I can't believe or I feel really anxious around these conversations or I can't believe it, it's centering you. And what we need to be doing is centering that person, healing that wound. But the other thing that it does is it communicates to me that up until this point, you were not aware that this existed. You thought we lived in a homophobia-free society. And yet every day I have to change the way I behave so that I don't meet homophobia. I have to bite down a really snappy response when someone asks my child who is her real mum because she has two mummies. And I know what they're really asking and what they're perpetuating and what they're reinforcing to my child. And if I was to kick off about it, I would be the unreasonable one. And I have to consider that when both my girlfriend and I walk out, we like to wear shirts and ties. We are, as our friend Seth Petherick calls us, we are the handsome sapphics. That is our style aesthetic. We get hissed at. Yeah. I absolutely am going to front a band called Handsome Sapphics. This is my global reveal on your podcast. But we experience more homophobia when we're dressed that way. We experience it from men who see that we've rejected them. And so when somebody says in this day and age, or I'm really shocked, what they're telling me is that they were unaware that I had to live with this every day. And there is a great online activist called Rachel Cargill who... she does amazing work, actually, and she runs a Patreon and she runs a tip jar, which I regularly throw money in because she has educated me so much. And it is never a person's job to educate me. That's what she's chosen to do with her activism. Mm-hmm. But she talked about in that moment, your eyes lit up and you communicated to me that you felt the pain, but you didn't feel my pain. You felt your pain. And what I need you right now to do is help me heal this wound. And I just think she talks about it so well. It's just, you can express the shock because it is shocking. And you can say, this is absolutely shocking. But what you need to do is come back to that person and be with them in that moment and ask them, what do you need? And the best responses I've heard is just kind of, isn't even belittling, you know, the perpetrators. It's just they've really stuck with me and they've really affirmed who I am, because, you know, responses like, well, it's no one's business, kind of makes me feel like I'm a dirty bedroom secret, to be honest. Like, well, it's no one's business who you sleep with. Okay. I was kind of cool with it, but because it again, that's something that sounds like they've equated my sexual identity with what I do with my sex life.
Yeah.
They're two different things.
Yeah.
And it brings in this idea of shamefulness around sex, which for any sexuality is not cool. Like, you know, get on with your loving self. That's a great thing to not be ashamed of.
But aren't we so great at shaming our children's sex lives from a really early age in Britain?
My goodness.
I think we were talking about this and it's an opinion I've had for a long time and I find it disgusting, the thought that I would ever have to, at any age, come out to my mum and dad and say, hey, I've weighed things up, I've thought about it, but I've decided, on balance, I think I'd like to have sex with men. The thought that I would ever have to do that to my parents. So therefore, I would like you to refer to me as your heterosexual daughter and you can just tell everybody going forward that men is who I want to sleep with. Just disgusting. Like, I can't even imagine having to do that.
Yeah, I yearn for a world where it just isn't. And that I have to, every new relationship, be it a professional one, you know, a colleague, a peer, so a mum at the school gate, teacher, I have to, at what point do I slide in?
Yeah.
And it is easy when you're in a relationship. So say, oh, my girlfriend can come pick her up.
Or,
you know, and I'm very careful not to say partner, because I want to make it clear. It's quite a gentle way of putting it in there quite early. Because there's a thing sometimes that happens that people feel quite shocked that you didn't tell them straight away. Like, maybe you didn't trust them. I was like, I don't remember disclosing when I was in a relationship with a man. It didn't seem to matter one bit whatsoever. So I'm not sure why I had to this time. But because I'm prepared for that reaction, I have to manage that a lot. And that stuff builds up. It's really tiring. And it never stops, because you'll always meet someone that you have to come out to. Like, it never stops, the coming out and the the weird reactions to it.
We sort of fetishise the coming out process, don't we?
Oh, we really do. Everyone loves a good coming out story. I've never told mine because I just, I think people, they either want to hear there was tears and, oh, we've always seen you and this amazing story and come here and they tuck you under their arm and you all weep together in this very cathartic moment, which in itself is gross, that idea. I mean, I'm, you know, that's beautiful in some ways, but also like that's what we uphold. Or there was a screaming, raging and you were kicked out, which is the reality for so many people, so many. It's really common within my community, in our community, to have weddings where the family aren't present. That's or there's a friend that isn't present. There's somebody who should be there at a wedding isn't. That's really not uncommon still, and it's exhausting. So yeah, it's a really weird, it's a weird thing, and I can often see that sort of slight, oh, at this, they might get the story reaction, which was me think, you are not the person that I need. Or I just say, there was no reaction, nothing, absolutely nothing. We've never spoken of it since. And you can just see people like, I don't know how to process that. Like, cool, but you're really glad you asked now, aren't you?
Yeah.
Your eyes lit up, you wanted a story. Yeah. There you go.
It will not be made into a TV movie.
Yeah, you don't know what to do with it. It is uncomfortable. You are correct.
We shouldn't laugh because that's also incredibly hurtful to have no reaction as well.
Yeah, it is, and it's something that I don't, you know, I don't talk about my family particularly online. I think it's fairly obvious why, or at least it is, I think, to a lot of people who also identify as queer who follow me. You know, we get it.
Thank you so, so much for being a podcast guest again.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. It's always good talking to you.
Yeah, likewise. Where can everybody find you online?
You can find me as Kate_O_Sullivan on most social media. I'm Instagrammy. I rant a lot on Twitter. I like a good chat on Twitter. Come and say hi. I'm kateosullivan.org. It's my website where you will find Conversations from Our Days, which is my podcast, which publishes fortnightly. And I'm even on Patreon, where I'm growing lots of conversations even further and even more in depth, because I am funding the fact that I do all this information sharing for free. I transcribe every podcast because I really try and walk my talk, which is quite expensive, it turns out.
Yes, go and support Kate everywhere. Thanks for listening. You can find me at Lucy Lucroft everywhere. You can find old episodes of What She Said over at lucylucroft.com, where you'll also find me chatting about all things blogging, travel, vegan life, and zero waste living too. Lastly, I know everybody asks this and it's a total pain in the ass, but please think about leaving the show a rating and review. It makes a huge difference to getting the show out to new listeners. And for every review you leave, I'll donate £2 to charity.
This month's charity is Endometriosis UK. If you leave a review, I'll give £1 and I'll give £1 on your behalf. So £2 for every review left.